In this talk, Dr. Martos looks at the beginnings of ministry in the church and shows how these gradually developed into a set of ecclesiastical ministries known as holy orders. He describes how these ancient orders of episcopacy, priesthood, diaconate, and so on continued through the Middle Ages, but were largely rejected for a variety of reasons by many Protestants in the 16th century Reformation. Finally, he discusses how changes in the Church since the Second Vatican Council are allowing Catholics not only to retain the traditional forms of ecclesiastical orders, but also to expand on the ways that ministry is viewed within the Church.
When we look at the picture of the early Church which is given in the New Testament, what we discover is that it was much more loosely organized than the Church is today. And we also discover that it was organized differently than the Church is today. We didn't fully realize this in the past, because some of the names of the early Christian ministers and ministries are the same names that were used later in the Church, for example, bishop and deacon. But during the past 20 or 30 years, Scripture scholars have been taking a much closer look at what those called bishops and deacons, presbyters and evangelists and others, were doing in the early Christian community. And they have concluded that we should not easily identify ministers and ministries in the Church today with those that are found in the New Testament. Who then are the ministers that are mentioned in the Scriptures, and what was their ministry? What were they doing in and for the Christian community? First, there were the 12, as they were sometimes called, not the 12 apostles, but simply the 12. They were commonly referred to as the 12 apostles in later Christian history because there are some New Testament texts in which they are called apostles. But, as we shall see in a few seconds, apostles were something like missionaries, and most of the 12 never left Palestine, despite later legends to the contrary. The 12, then, were those close associates of Jesus, perhaps some of his earliest and most devout disciples, who formed the core of the earliest Christian community, especially when it was not fully distinct from the Jewish community, and who were the spokesmen and teachers of the community the way rabbis and elders were in Jewish communities. And since 12 is a symbolic number, standing for the 12 tribes of Israel, it may be that the 12 simply represent the Church, which was seen as the new Israel when the Gospels were written. Second, then, there were those who were actually called apostles, or apostolos in Greek. The word literally means one who is sent forth. And so the apostles were men who were sent from the early community out into the neighboring countryside, or even into far countries to proclaim the message of Jesus. In some ways, then, they were like Catholic missionaries. But in other ways, they were more like Protestant evangelists, who move from one city to another, preaching the basic message of the gospel, but who don't stay very long in any one place. This is why St. Paul, for example, could refer to himself as an apostle. It was not because he was one of the 12, but because he was a missionary to the Gentiles. Thirdly, another general term for early Christian preachers was prophet, or prophetos in Greek, since the word designates someone who speaks on behalf of someone else, such as the Old Testament prophets, who spoke to Israel on behalf of God. A prophet in the early Christian community was therefore someone who had the gift of inspired preaching. Sometimes they exercised their ministry within established communities, and sometimes they traveled from town to town, preaching either to Christians or to non-Christians in hopes of converting them. And, in this latter respect, they were a lot like those who were called apostles. Fourthly, once a Christian community was established in a town by an apostle or traveling prophet, very often he would leave a group of people in charge to be the leaders of the community while he was away. Sometimes these leaders were among the first converts in that community, and so they were its oldest Christians. In any event, they had to be mature and responsible persons, and the traditional name for such persons in the Jewish community was elders, or presbyteroi in Greek, which is why elders are sometimes referred to as presbyters. The elders looked after things in the community, gathering it together for weekly prayer, initiating new members, making sure that the poor in the community were cared for, and so on. St. Paul's epistles give indications that in some places the elders were a husband-wife team, suggesting that in the very early church, both men and women could hold positions of community leadership. Fifthly, another ministry which was open to women was that of diaconia, or service. The Acts of the Apostles describes the appointments of the first deacons in chapter 6, though scripture scholars today question whether these were the literal forerunners of the office of deacon in the church. Nevertheless, it makes sense that in the early days, there would have been those who performed practical services for the members of the community under the leadership of the presbyters. And so their work was seen as a ministry of service, and they themselves were sometimes called deacons, which in Greek means servants. At the very beginning, many of the earliest communities outside Jerusalem would have consisted of something like a few families. And so the presbyters were a small group, something like a standing committee, who jointly supervised the community on behalf of the apostle or prophet who had founded it. As the early Christian communities grew larger, however, a new form of ministry began to emerge. And so, sixthly, the New Testament also speaks of supervisors or overseers, episkopoi in Greek. It's the word from which we get the terms episcopate and episcopal, referring to bishops. But it's a word which literally means to supervise or oversee, and it was used in the New Testament to refer to those persons who looked over things in the community, making sure that everything that was supposed to get done was actually getting done. Sometimes the word was used to refer to the whole group of presbyters. Sometimes it seems that there might have been one of these presbyters or elders who acted as a sort of chairperson for the community's steering committee, as it were. Seventhly and finally, in addition to those more or less formally designated ministries within the Christian community, the New Testament epistles also mention other more spontaneous or charismatic ministries that seem to have been performed by whoever had the gifts or charisms for doing them, things such as preaching or teaching at prayer meetings, speaking in tongues or interpreting what was said in tongues, so that others might understand what was said under the inspiration of the Spirit. And again, both men and women seem to have had these charisms and performed these ministries in the early church. Some conclusions that we can reach, therefore, about ministry in the early church are, 1. There was a variety of ministers and ministries in the community. 2. There were those who exercised leadership and responsibility in the community, both in the community's worship and in the administration of its affairs. But there is no hard and clear evidence that these leaders were ordained or commissioned by the 12 or by the traveling apostles using any specific ceremony such as the laying on of hands. On the other hand, however, the absence of such evidence does not prove that there was no such ordination or commission ritual in the early church. 3. None of those who performed ministerial functions in the community were officially designated as priest. The only priests that the early Christians knew and wrote about were either the Jewish temple priests or priests in the Roman religion who offered sacrifices at various temples around the empire. The epistle to the Hebrews does speak of Christ as a high priest, since he offered himself on the cross to God, and so he offered the perfect and final sacrifice for the salvation of the human race. And the first letter of Peter refers to the church as a community of priests, picking up a theme from the Old Testament which referred to Israel as a holy people and a nation of priests. During the first 3 centuries of Christianity, as the communities grew larger and more widespread, there was a natural tendency for ministry in the church to become more organized and structured. The organizational structure, which gradually emerged throughout the Roman Empire, was one in which the episkopos, or overseeing elder, was seen as both the spiritual father and the administrative leader of the community. This bishop, as we might call him now, was assisted by some full-time and part-time ministers who inherited the title of diakonos, or deacon, and he was advised by a council of elders or a committee of presbyters for whom this was just a part-time ministry and who functioned more or less as an advisory council or board of trustees for the community. Now, it was ordinarily the bishop, as the spiritual leader of the community in each city, who presided over the weekly celebrations of the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist, although occasionally one of the other presbyters might substitute for him, even as they had often done from the earliest days of the Church. And when, through the course of the second and third centuries, Eucharistic worship began to be interpreted as a sort of sacrifice, somewhat because of the necessity to explain the spiritual dynamics of Christian worship to non-Christians, and somewhat under the influence of the Epistle to the Hebrews, the ordinary leader of Eucharistic worship, namely the bishop, began to be spoken of as a priest of some sort, since he represented the community in offering bread and wine and the community itself to God in commemoration of and in union with Christ's sacrificial offering of himself on the cross. During this period, the bishops were usually elected, either by the whole community if it was small enough, or by the council of presbyters, whose choice had to be approved by the whole community. By about the year 200, it seems that in most places, bishops, deacons, and presbyters were commissioned through a special ritual of the laying on of hands by other bishops and presbyters. But the prayers that were said during this ceremony asked for God's blessing and strength for the newly selected leaders and signified the people's approval of them. In other words, the ceremony at this time does not seem to have been interpreted as a bestowal or a transfer of power from the established ministers to the new ministers. During the 4th century, when Christianity was first recognized as a legal religion and later established as the official religion of the Roman Empire, the size of the Christian community in each city grew so large that it became first difficult and later impossible for the bishop to preside over the celebration of the Eucharist every week. Now, deacons, who up till this point were the bishop's chief assistants, had no tradition of presiding over the Eucharist in the bishop's absence, but the presbyters did. And so gradually, bishops in each city began to appoint presbyters to perform this Eucharistic function, both in various urban neighborhoods and in the surrounding rural areas. But when they did this, two things happened. First, the role of presbyter in the church began to change. Whereas previously the presbyters had been a council of elders with few, if any, liturgical functions, now they were individual pastors of local communities with responsibility for the weekly liturgy and yearly baptisms. Second, as the presbyters became Eucharistic celebrants, they too, like the bishop, came to be regarded as priests, for they presided over the Eucharistic offering of the body of Christ to God the Father. Moreover, during this period of growth and expansion in the church, the various ministries became even more organized and structured, so that tasks which had once been assigned to lay people began to be given to those who were specifically trained for the job. There thus emerged a gradual structuring or ordering of these ministerial functions, ranging from custodial and secretarial duties, for example, the orders of porter and acolyte, up to liturgical and administrative duties, the orders of lector, exorcist, deacon, presbyter, and bishop. In this way, the church's ministerial system became an established set of ministerial orders, each with a certain prestige or rank when compared with the others. And it eventually became common to train young men for eventual ordination as parish or diocesan pastors by making them begin at the bottom, so to speak, and work their way up through the various orders, and so ordination gradually turned into a series of ordinations through a set of hierarchical or holy orders. Also during this period, ordination itself began to be viewed differently. Because of the growing complexity of church organization, because of the power struggles that sometimes arose between different factions in the church, and because the role of the minister in baptism and penance at the Eucharist and that ordinations began to be interpreted as one of performing a special service, which lay people could not perform, ordination itself began to be perceived as a bestowal of power or a transfer of priestly power from the one ordaining to the one being ordained. This is why it was sometimes asked, for example, whether baptisms, liturgies, and ordinations performed by heretics and schismatics were valid or not. The question, put first in legal terms and later in metaphysical terms, was whether those performing the ceremony had the power to perform them, or to ensure that they had the effects that they were supposed to have. And so the ordination prayers changed during this period from being requests for God's blessing to being conferrals of priestly power. Finally, it was during the patristic period that bishops first and later presbyters as well began to wear distinctive clothing, which set them visibly apart from the rest of the community. Because bishops were already respected members of society, Constantine and later Roman emperors gave them authority to act as magistrates or judges in matters which did not demand much legal training. Along with this authority came permission to wear special signs of their position, and bishops began to wear these insignia, first of all at public functions such as the liturgy, and later as part of their everyday dress. Presbyters, too, eventually adopted the long tunic of the nobility, rather than the short tunic of the common people, as a sign of their pastoral and priestly authority. From this point onward, therefore, liturgical vestments and clerical dress began to evolve in patterns which were different from the clothing worn by ordinary Christians. The great challenge to Christianity after the downfall of the Roman Empire, as we've already seen, was the conversion of the pagan and barbarian tribes, some of whom had invaded southern Europe and the rest of whom were still inhabiting northern Europe. But where could the needed missionaries be found to undertake this arduous and risky task? The natural place to find them was in the monasteries, where men were already committed to lives of penitence and asceticism. There was only one difficulty with this idea. Almost all of the men in the monasteries at this point were laymen, not priests. And so, to overcome this difficulty, bishops began to ordain monks as priests so that they might bring the Mass and the sacraments to those that they baptized in the mission lands. Some bishops, especially the Bishop of Rome, who organized a number of these missionary ventures, even ordained some monks as bishops, giving them the power and authority to ordain other priests, native clergy, so to speak, from among their converts to the faith. Now, monks, since they were vowed to a life of asceticism, were also vowed to a life of celibacy, since as monks they had renounced all worldly pleasures and pursuits. And since, beginning in the 7th and 8th centuries, a great number of priests in northern Europe and even in the rural areas of the south were monks, a sufficient percentage of the Catholic clergy were celibate, or at least they were supposed to be. Celibacy is not too difficult to maintain when there is a large number of monks living together in the common life of the monastery. But when individual priests were put in charge of rural country parishes, the old monastic ideal of celibacy was hard to maintain. And so, from the 7th to the 11th century, there was something of a discrepancy between the monastic ideal of holiness, which called for the abstinence from sexual pleasure, and the actual practice of priests, most of whom were married. Now this practice was in no way different from what had been the practice during the patristic period, when most priests were in fact married, and there were even married bishops. But the introduction of the monastic ideal of asceticism into the priesthood eventually led those who wished to reform the clergy, and the priesthood, like any other human institution, needed periodic reforming, to insist on clerical celibacy as a necessity for all priests. Remember, however, that for a long period it was possible under Roman law for two people to marry each other even without the presence of official witnesses. And so it was not until the reforms of the 12th century, when the bishops and the church courts took legal control over marriage in the absence of such controls by civil authorities, that the bishops could, on the one hand, insist that all priests remain celibate, and on the other hand, they could declare that any clerical marriages were null and void. But it was not only the spiritual ideal of monastic asceticism that ultimately led to the rule of celibacy for all priests in the Western Church. In both the ancient and medieval world, sexual activity was sometimes viewed as potentially, if not actually, sinful. And because priests were regarded as sacred persons who performed sacred functions, there was a moral mentality that somehow priestly actions and marital responsibilities were incompatible. And finally, there were practical advantages to an unmarried clergy. Celibate individuals could be more easily assigned and reassigned to wherever they were needed. And there was also less danger that ecclesiastical property would be lost to the church if priests and bishops had no children who could inherit it. This latter consideration was probably not such a great factor for the lower clergy, and especially the rural clergy, who were usually poor anyhow. But it was an important factor in the case of the upper clergy, for many of the bishops by the Middle Ages had become landowners with very large estates, either through lands being donated to the church, or because the bishops, with the financial resources of the diocese at their disposal, acquired new property from which they could get additional revenue. Thus, although a rule of celibacy might have put the families of individual bishops at a financial disadvantage, celibacy as a rule for all clerics had a definite economic advantage for the institutional church. During all this time, the ordination ceremony was also undergoing changes and modifications in various parts of Europe. In many places, the imposition of hands was still the central part of the ceremony, just as it had been in patristic times. But in monasteries, the initiation ceremony for new monks included a ritual dressing of the candidate in the monastic robe or habit. And in Mediterranean lands, it was customary to invest people into positions of authority by symbolically dressing them in the special vestments that they were now allowed to wear as a sign of their new position. Finally, among the Germanic tribes themselves, this same sort of delegation of authority was often symbolized by the handing over of certain signs of office, a crown, a key, a medallion, or so on. Gradually, in the Middle Ages, many symbolic gestures such as these found themselves into the ordination ceremonies that were in use in various parts of Europe. Then, in the 13th century, a liturgist named William Durand composed an ordination ceremony which incorporated many of these symbolic elements into a single, continuous ritual, and within a short time, Durand's revision of the ordination ritual became so popular that it became first by custom and then by canon law the official ordination rite for the whole church. Thus, when the scholastic theologians in the 13th century came to examine the sacrament of ordination, it was difficult to establish the essential matter and form of the sacrament. During the ordination ceremony, the candidates were dressed in their priestly vestments, they were given the chalice and paten that they would use at Mass, they received the imposition of the bishop's hands as well as a blessing by the bishop, and they even had their own hands anointed with oil. At which point, then, the scholastics asked, was the person ordained? which was the essential part of the ritual for the conferring of the sacrament. To complicate the matter, the ordination to the priesthood was only the last in a series of ordinations through which candidates passed at various stages of their preparation for the priesthood. In all, there were 4 minor orders and 3 major orders that the candidates received, not counting the episcopal ordination, which was received by those who were later ordained bishops. Thus, it seemed to some theologians that what we had here was not one sacrament, but a sequence of sacraments, while others, like Thomas Aquinas, said no, there is only one sacrament of holy orders, but it is received in stages through each of these separate ordinations. But the key to understanding the medieval scholastic concept of priesthood and ordination was not to be found in any of these specific ceremonies, but in the general understanding that what ordination did was to confer special ministerial powers on those who received the various orders, and in particular, it conferred the priestly powers of offering the Mass, forgiving sins, and administering extreme unction on those who received the order of the priesthood. In this way, then, the scholastic understanding of orders was a paradigm example of the scholastic understanding of the sacraments in general, and an exact parallel to the scholastic understanding of baptism. In the scholastic theology of the sacraments in general, the sacrament that was received was some kind of change in the soul of the recipient. It was a change in one's spiritual potential, so to speak, or as we have already talked about it, it was a change in one's spiritual powers and abilities. Thus, baptism bestowed the power to believe with supernatural faith, to love with supernatural charity, and to look forward to the future with supernatural hope. Penance bestowed the ability to be spiritually reunited with God and to be reconciled with the Church. Marriage conferred an unbreakable bond between husband and wife and assured them of the spiritual strength needed to fulfill their duties as spouses, and orders was likewise seen as conferring priestly powers, and especially the power to change bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. But orders was in some ways also an exact parallel with the sacrament of baptism, for both baptism and orders were received only once, and under the influence of Augustine's theory of the sacramental character, the 13th century theologians also concluded that ordination must likewise bestow a character. The baptismal character was interpreted as a spiritual configuration or molding of the soul in the image of Christ, but Christ in the Epistle to the Hebrews is spoken of as the high priest. And so the priestly character was interpreted as an additional configuration to the image of Christ, the high priest. That is, with ordination, it was believed that the candidate began to participate in those same priestly powers which Christ had, and in virtue of which his death on the cross was in fact a sacrificial offering to God the Father, and his Last Supper with his disciples was in fact a sacramental anticipation of his redemptive death on the cross. But this theological identification of priesthood with power reinforced the popular understanding that the exercise of that power was automatic, that every time the priest said the words of consecration, the body and blood of Christ were instantly present on the altar, or that every time the priest said the words of absolution, the sins on a person's soul were immediately washed away. To some extent, too, the identification of priesthood with power made it possible to confuse power and authority, and made it possible for men to think that since they had the sacred power of the priesthood, they had the authority to use it in any way that seemed right to them, including the hurried and sloppy saying of Masses and the offering of repeated Masses every day for souls in purgatory in exchange for stipends, and including the extension of the ancient practice of indulgences to cover the sins of the dead in exchange for donations. It was abuses such as this sort, and excesses in the use of priestly power, which were in part responsible for the Protestant rejection of the scholastic theology of the priesthood and their replacement of it with a new theology of ministry. It seemed to Martin Luther, for example, that the theology of priesthood was too closely interwoven with the interpretation of the Mass as a sacrifice which could be offered for the ransom of souls. And so, by interpreting the Mass as a commemoration of the Lord's Supper, in which communion and not the consecration was the central act, he laid the theological groundwork for a new conception of ministry based on the priesthood of all believers, the notion that all Christians share in the priesthood of Christ in virtue of their baptism. According to Luther, then, all Christians were priests in the sense that they were joined by baptism and faith with Christ's redemptive death and resurrection. And so, those who were ordained to ministry in the church did not receive any new spiritual powers from God, but they only received a commission from the church to lead Christians in prayer, to exhort them through the Word of God, and to perform other pastoral services for the Christian community. John Calvin even went a step further in his own reevaluation of the nature and purpose of Christian ministry. To him it seemed that the root of the problem was to be found in the abuse of ecclesiastical power, which was made possible by organizing the hierarchy along the lines of a medieval monarchy. In the New Testament, Calvin pointed out, the local churches in Jerusalem, Antioch, Corinth, Galatia, and so on, were each relatively independent, and they were governed not by autocratic bishops, but by a council of elders or presbyters. Thus, Calvin reorganized the Reformed churches in his area along a more Presbyterian model, and insisted that Christian ministry was primarily a ministry of service rather than a ministry of power and authority. He also insisted that local churches had the right, therefore, to determine their own ministerial needs, as well as to call individuals into and to dismiss them from ministry. All of these revolutionary changes, however, flew directly in the face of centuries of Christian tradition, and so the Council of Trent in the 16th century had little hesitation in reaffirming the scholastic theology of the priesthood and in reasserting the Church's right to organize its clergy along the lines of a medieval hierarchy. Moreover, it found confirmation for the traditional Catholic view both in the Gospel texts where Christ gave the apostles the commission to celebrate the Eucharist and the power to forgive sins, also in the Book of Acts and the New Testament epistles, which show that the apostles, and especially Peter, had authority over the Christian community, and in the patristic writings which spoke of bishops, presbyters, and indeed other holy orders in ways that show that the hierarchical ordering of ministry in the church was not a medieval invention, as some of the reformers had claimed. On the practical side of things, however, the bishops who met at Trent had to admit that a lot had gone wrong with the medieval system. But their solution was not to get rid of the system, but to reform it from within, so that the abuses that it had led to could not happen in the future. Thus, many of the decrees of the Council of Trent were both directly and indirectly aimed at the reform of the Catholic clergy, and the reform of the way that Catholic priests discharged both their sacramental and their administrative duties. Bishops were to reside in their own diocese, and not be absent for long periods at a stretch. They were forbidden to hold more than one episcopal seat at a time for the purpose of increasing their revenues, and the practice of selling the episcopacy and other church offices to the highest bidder was abolished. Bishops were to establish ceremonies in each diocese for the spiritual formation and intellectual training of young men for the priesthood, and priests themselves were required to lead exemplary moral lives or else risk losing their right to exercise their priesthood. Finally, the reform of the sacramental rites themselves, as we have already seen, was done in such a way that it ensured that priests and bishops would perform the sacramental rituals in the way that Rome determined was the best way, thus avoiding the deviations and exaggerations in the Mass and other sacraments which the Protestant reformers had called unworthy of the Church of Christ. The reforms decreed by the Council of Trent indeed accomplished what they were supposed to do. Except for occasional scandals which were quickly corrected by ecclesiastical authorities, bishops and priests led exemplary lives during the modern centuries. And Catholic spiritual writers encouraged the clergy to adopt interior attitudes and external lifestyles patterned after those which had been once the ideal only for monks. They were to be in the world, but not of the world, confining their ministry to the care of souls, and for the most part, restricting their activity to personal prayer, spiritual reading, and the administration of the sacraments. Social changes in the modern world reinforce this conception of the priest as a holy person concerned with holy things and somewhat removed from secular matters. In the 18th and 19th century, the church lost much of its economic wealth and political power due to nationalist movements which expropriated large landholdings once owned by dioceses and monasteries, due to secularist movements which took over control of marriage, education, and medical care, which had once been the province of the church, and due to anti-clerical sentiment even in Catholic countries such as France and Italy, which viewed the church as an archaic institution which blocked the path to modernity in science and education, in political and social reform. As a result, the church as a whole withdrew into itself, contemplating the achievements of its glorious past, seeing the ideal of Christian life as it had been in the Middle Ages, and even in the great missionary efforts which marked this period, the goal was always, or at least it appeared to be, the establishment of European Catholic enclaves surrounded by peoples of other cultures and other religions. The Catholic clergy, of course, since they were the official representatives of the Church, epitomized this view, and so they saw themselves as the true inheritors and transmitters of the Catholic tradition. They alone were the Church's ministers, dispensing its sacraments, preaching its doctrines, preserving its moral standards. Thus, Christian ministry continued to be, as it had been in the Middle Ages, primarily a clerical ministry, a priestly ministry. Lay Catholics were never ministers. Rather, they were the ones who were ministered to. This picture has changed quite radically, however, in the period following the Second Vatican Council. During the Middle Ages, there had been a number of councils called to implement reform in the Church. Sometimes they succeeded, as in the 12th and 13th century, but most of the ones in the later Middle Ages failed, and the result was the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. The Council of Trent was also in the 16th century, and the next Reformed Council after that was the Second Vatican Council in the 20th century. This council did little directly to change the Catholic priesthood, but it did call for the aggiornamento, the modernization of the Church as a whole. It did initiate a rethinking and a revising of the Catholic sacramental system, and it did call for a renewal of religious orders, diocesan institutions, and parish structures. Perhaps most importantly, from the perspective of ministry, it suggested that priests might break out of their traditional role as dispensers of the sacraments and teachers of the faith and become more actively involved in other social ministries, even with the poor and the oppressed. Conversely, it invited lay people to become more active and involved in the church, to participate in the liturgy, to give advice and even make decisions in church matters, and to assist the clergy in their newly expanded ministerial activities. The result of this was a blurring of the traditionally clear distinction between clerical and non-clerical roles in the church, and in the resulting confusion, many priests left the clergy to pursue non-priestly ministries or even to leave the ministry entirely. One of the consequences of the demonasticization of the priesthood, if we might call it that, has been the raising of the question of clerical celibacy. As we have seen, historically, celibacy became attached to the priesthood because many of the clerics in the early Middle Ages were monks, who were celibate not because they were priests, but because they were monks. And when the monastic ideal became identified with the ideal of sanctity for priests, the Church adopted its now traditional rule of clerical celibacy. But today, the priestly vocation is no longer identified with the monastic vocation, either explicitly as was done in the Middle Ages, or implicitly as it was done in the modern period. And so the question of whether priests should have to be celibate has become and remains an open question in the Church. Another open question today is, of course, the question of ordaining women to the priesthood. Again, historical studies have shown that in the New Testament period, and even in the early patristic period, women had ministerial roles and even positions of leadership in the Church. There were certainly women deacons, and there may even have been women presbyters in the earliest Christian communities. These historical precedents and the sociological realization that one of the main reasons for the exclusion of women from leadership in the Church was that through much of European history, women as a group were excluded from positions of leadership in all of society, has led both women and men to wonder whether the time has come for a rethinking and restructuring of the priesthood so as to include women in the ordained ministry. But by far, the greatest rethinking in regard to the priesthood has revolved around the question of the nature of the priesthood itself. For centuries, the essence of the priesthood has been identified with priestly power, the power of priests to offer the Mass and to forgive sins, the power of bishops to rule the Church and to ordain priests, and so on. But New Testament scholars point out that Jesus, who is the perennial paradigm of the priesthood, conceived of his life's work not in terms of power, but in terms of service. Likewise, liturgical experts point out that the real effectiveness of the sacraments is not directly the result of priestly power, but the combined result of many factors, including the dispositions that people bring to their sacramental worship and including the actual way that the sacraments are celebrated. So once again, the priest's role, even in sacramental worship, is being perceived less in terms of power and more in terms of service, a service of helping the local community to become a truly Christian community, and a service of organizing community worship in such a way that it is as sacramental as possible. The ultimate results of all these changes in the priesthood and in the Catholic ministry are hard to predict. On the one hand, the number of ordained priests in proportion to the overall Catholic population is declining. On the other hand, the number of lay people, that is, non-ordained persons who are actively engaged in ministerial work, is increasing. Will this lead to the ordination of married persons as priests, a step which has already been partly taken with the reintroduction of the permanent diaconate? Will this lead to the ordination of women, a step which has been discreetly but indirectly taken with the appointment of women to pastoral ministry in the Church? Only time will tell. But if the history of the priesthood and the history of the Church's sacraments is any precedent, then we can say with certainty that there will be change in the future.